In our previous lecture, we examined the careers and judicial philosophies of two of the most influential justices in the Supreme Court's history, Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis. We saw that Holmes doubted the ability of the people to make wise choices in public affairs, but he equally doubted the ability of judges to substitute their judgments for those of elected lawmakers. Holmes became a firm advocate of what we now call judicial restraint, of deferring to legislative decisions on matters of economic regulation. Brandeis shared Holmes's belief in judicial restraint in economic cases. But in contrast to Holmes, Brandeis trusted the people's common sense in matters that affected their pocketbooks and working conditions. In this lecture, we're going to explore the Supreme Court's rulings in economic regulation cases during a period of great change and conflict in American society. This period spanned the last two decades of the 19th century and the first two decades of the 20th. These were years of rapid economic growth, fueled by such booming industries as steel and textiles. But these were also years of intense political and social conflict. The factories and mines and railroads that created great wealth for their owners had insatiable appetites for cheap labor. But the workers who filled these jobs endured long hours and low wages. Their jobs were often dirty and dangerous, and thousands died every year from accidents and illness. Millions of small farmers also produced livestock and grain and shipped their goods to markets on railroads that charged exorbitant rates. Many workers joined unions that pressed state lawmakers to pass laws setting minimum wages and maximum hours, and farmers lobbied for state regulation of railroads and grain elevators. We need to keep in mind the economic and political context of this period as a backdrop for our examination of Supreme Court rulings in cases that involve these progressive laws. And we need to remember that political conflicts over these laws were mirrored by conflicts among the justices who decided whether the laws were constitutional. The basic question was this: who decides what policies are necessary and reasonable? Elected lawmakers responding to public sentiment, or unelected judges guided by the broad provisions of the Constitution? The justices looked for answers to this question in the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, which protects liberty and property against state deprivation. How the court defined and applied the Due Process Clause became the central issue in the cases we'll examine. But this question also requires some background and context before we turn to our first case. The intense political battles of this period were matched by equally intense battles over judicial doctrine. Beginning in the 1860s, a number of influential legal scholars and judges debated the proper meaning of the Due Process Clause. On one side were those who believed that judges should limit themselves to examining the process by which a law was enacted. If lawmakers followed the legislative rules in passing a law, and if the law was a reasonable exercise of the state's police powers, judges should uphold the law. The doctrine of police powers had its origins in the English common law, which recognized the authority of lawmakers to protect the public health, safety, welfare, and morals. Laws which were reasonable in protecting these public interests were safe from constitutional challenge. This doctrine became known as procedural due process, in which judges looked only at the procedures by which laws were enacted. On the other side of this debate were those who championed the emerging doctrine that became known as substantive due process. Under this doctrine, judges were free to examine the substance of the law to see whether it deprived any person of their liberty or property. If the judges agreed that it did, they could strike it down as a violation of the Due Process Clause. The doctrine of substantive due process allowed judges to substitute their views of a law's reasonableness for those of elected lawmakers. The most influential advocate of substantive due process was Thomas Cooley, a Michigan judge and law professor, who published a book called A Treatise on Constitutional Limitations in 1868. In Cooley's words, a legislative enactment is not necessarily the law of the land. Laws that passed all the procedural tests of due process violated the Constitution if they represented arbitrary interference by the state with rights of private property. Cooley read the term liberty of contract into the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Under this new doctrine, if a law interfered with the right of any person, even a corporation, to make any lawful contract, in Cooley's words, it can scarcely be doubted that the act would transcend the due bounds of legislative power, even if it did not come into conflict with express constitutional provisions. The liberty of contract doctrine included agreements between workers and employers over wages and working conditions, and contracts between farmers and railroads over shipping rates. Now, the first battle in the Supreme Court over Cooley's doctrine of liberty of contract was fought in 1877. It's not coincidental that 1877 was a year of bitter and often bloody social conflict in the United States. The country was still in the grip of a major depression that began with the Panic of 1873, which cost millions of workers their jobs and led banks to foreclose thousands of farm mortgages. Farmers in Illinois were angry over the high rates charged for grain storage in Chicago. Wheat poured into the city's grain elevators from railroad cars and was stored for sale to millers and bakers. Farmers persuaded the state legislature to set a maximum charge of 2 cents per bushel for grain storage. But the owners of Chicago's largest grain storage business, the company of Munn and Scott, refused to obey the law and were convicted in state court of charging more than the rate set by the legislature. When the case of Munn versus Illinois reached the Supreme Court in 1877, the company's lawyers charged that the Illinois law deprived its owners of their liberty to engage in business free of arbitrary state regulation. And they pointed the justices to Cooley's treatise on constitutional limitations for legal authority. But the court declined this invitation to read Cooley's views into the Constitution. Chief Justice Morrison Waite, who was himself a former corporate and railroad lawyer, wrote for a majority of 7 in upholding the law as a reasonable regulation of a virtual monopoly of the grain storage business. Waite cited another legal scholar, the eminent jurist Lord Matthew Hale, an English law professor of great renown, for support. Hale had written that when private property is affected with a public interest, it ceases to be private only. The Illinois law, Waite ruled, came within the meaning of the doctrine which Lord Hale has so forcibly stated. Waite concluded that the grain storage business in Chicago is devoted to a public use and is subject to public regulation. The Chief Justice had these words for the advocates of substantive due process. For protection against abuses by legislatures, the people must resort to the polls, not to the courts. The most vehement response to Waite's opinion came from Justice Stephen Field, who served on the court from 1863 until 1897, and who consistently defended the rights of corporations against what he called the assault on capital by vote-seeking politicians. Field denounced the ruling in the Munn case as subversive of the rights of private property, heretofore believed to be protected by constitutional guarantees against legislative interference. He denied that any business was subject to state regulation of its prices or rates, and concluded with this dire prophecy: if this be sound law, all property and all business in the state are held at the mercy of a majority of its legislature. Justice Field lost this first skirmish over substantive due process, but he led the court's conservatives in later battles over economic regulation. 10 years after the Munn decision, another justice gave Field and his troops a partial victory in a case from Kansas. This state was an early target of the temperance crusade led by Carrie Nation, who was a Kansas resident, and the state legislature passed a law in 1881. That banned the manufacture and sale of intoxicating liquors in Kansas. The Saline County District Attorney promptly charged Peter Mugler with violating the law by selling beer. Mugler owned a brewery that quenched the thirst of the county's German farmers and factory workers. Justice John Marshall Harlan wrote for the court in Mugler v. Kansas in 1887. He rejected Mugler's claims that the Prohibition Law deprived him of both liberty and property in violation of the 14th Amendment. Harlan cited the Munn case for the proposition that society has the power to protect itself by legislation against the injurious consequences of the liquor trade. He agreed that the power to decide what laws are necessary to protect the public is lodged with the legislative branch of the government. But Harlan was not willing to hand a blank check to the states. "It does not at all follow," he wrote, "that every law is to be accepted as a legitimate exertion of the police powers of the state. There are, of necessity, limits beyond which legislation cannot go." Harlan believed that marking these constitutional limits was a job for judges. He put his views into these words: "They are at liberty, indeed are under a solemn duty, to look at the substance of things whenever they enter upon the inquiry whether the legislature has transcended the limits of its authority." 3 years later, Harlan's colleagues accepted his invitation in the Mugler case to look at the substance of laws in a railroad regulation case. Now, it's worth noting that railroad cases dominated the court's docket in the last third of the 19th century, reflecting conflicts over the industry's enormous power, both political and economic. One railroad magnate boasted that he had purchased the Pennsylvania legislature, and he got good value for his money. The railroad case the court decided in 1890 involved a Minnesota law that established a commission to set reasonable rates for freight traffic. Three justices had joined the court since the Mugler decision, although the new members did not shift the court's conservative balance. Chief Justice Morrison Waite died in 1888 after 14 years of undistinguished service. President Grover Cleveland, who was a conservative Democrat, replaced Waite with Melville Fuller, a wealthy corporate lawyer in Chicago. One newspaper described Fuller as the most obscure man ever nominated for Chief Justice. He was also one of the most conservative. Fuller had supported Stephen Douglas over Abraham Lincoln for senator and president. He backed a state constitutional amendment to deny voting rights to blacks, and he had denounced the Emancipation Proclamation. On the other hand, his loyalty to business clients was never questioned. As one biographer put it, "The Fuller Court would go down in history as the incarnation of free enterprise, of the equation of laissez-faire with constitutionally protected rights." President Cleveland's successor, Benjamin Harrison, was an equally conservative Republican who placed four justices on the court during his single term in office from 1889 to 1893. All four of the new justices had been corporate lawyers. Harrison's first and most conservative nominee was David Brewer of Kansas, who joined his uncle, Justice Stephen Field, on the court. Brewer told the Yale graduates of 1891 that the principles of, as he said, of absolute and eternal justice forbid that any private property could be destroyed in the interests of public health, morals, or welfare. In other words, the police powers of government must yield to the rights of property. President Harrison's other three nominees, Henry Brown of Michigan, George Shiras of Pennsylvania, and Howell Jackson of Tennessee, were uniformly conservative and totally undistinguished. The only notable ruling by any of these three, Brown's majority opinion in the separate but equal case of Plessy v. Ferguson, was also one of the court's worst decisions. Now, the court struck down the Minnesota Railroad rate law by a 6-3 margin in the case of the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railway Company versus Minnesota. Justice Samuel Blatchford, who followed Justice Field in the battle over substantive due process, had the honor of announcing its victory. "Deciding the reasonableness of rate charges," Blatchford wrote, is eminently a question for judicial investigation, requiring due process of law for its determination. The Minnesota Railroad Commission had conducted extensive hearings before setting up the rates for railroads, but the court threw out its findings with no reference to the record. Justice Joseph Bradley wrote for the three dissenters in the Chicago-Milwaukee case. Bradley had joined the majority in Munn v. Illinois in 1877, upholding the rates set for grain elevators in Chicago. He now complained that the court's decision, as he said, practically overrules the Munn decision. Bradley's complaint was legitimate, but the court was now controlled by the advocates of substantive due process and liberty of contract. As the 19th century neared its end, the corporate lawyers who dominated the Supreme Court flexed their judicial muscles. They showed their greatest strength in 1895 in a trio of landmark cases. In the first of these rulings, the court virtually gutted the Sherman Antitrust Act, which Congress had passed in 1890, to curb the power of giant monopolies that ruled many industries. The law made it illegal to form a combination or conspiracy to restrain trade and interstate commerce. The federal government filed a suit to break up the American Sugar Refining Company and its subsidiaries, which controlled 98% of the industry. Every justice but John Marshall Harlan voted to limit the reach of the Sherman Act in the case of United States versus the E.C. Knight Company. Chief Justice Fuller wrote for the court, holding that the Commerce Clause of the Constitution did not allow Congress to regulate the manufacture of products that were later shipped in interstate commerce. As Fuller put it, commerce succeeds to manufacture and is not a part of it. He simply ignored the obvious fact that the whole point of commerce is to ship manufactured goods from the seller to the buyer. Monopoly control over prices flows from control over production. But Fuller's ruling in the E.C. Knight case remained the controlling doctrine for another four decades, until the court changed its mind during the Great Depression of the 1930s. The second landmark case, decided in 1895, involved another federal law that Congress passed in response to pressure from populist groups. The first national income tax imposed a 2% levy on corporate profits and personal incomes. But the exemption of those with incomes under $4,000 freed most workers from taxation, and the law's burden fell largely on the wealthy class. One member of this class, a man named Charles Pollock of New York, filed a suit on behalf of fellow shareholders in the Farmers Loan and Trust Company, seeking to block the bank from paying the tax. The bank's lawyers argued that the law violated the provision in Article 2 of the Constitution that no direct tax could be imposed unless in proportion to the census of the population. In other words, federal taxes must apply the same rate to everyone without any exemptions based on income. Chief Justice Fuller wrote for a narrow majority of five in striking down the federal tax law in Pollock v. Farmers Loan and Trust Company. Fuller's opinion distorted history and twisted precedent, dismissing the court's rulings in cases that went back to 1796 as what he called a century of error on the question of taxation. Justice Henry Brown put his dissent in pointed words. The decision involves nothing less than a surrender of the taxing power to the moneyed class. Labor and progressive groups denounced the Pollock decision, but not until 1912 did they muster enough political strength to persuade Congress to enact the 16th Amendment, which the states ratified the following year. This amendment gave Congress the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without regard to any census or enumeration. This was the third time in the court's history that Congress and the states had responded to unpopular decisions by amending the Constitution. The last of the court's major decisions in 1895 provoked another storm of protest, even calls for judicial impeachment. The year before, thousands of railroad workers had joined a national strike under the leadership of Eugene Debs, who headed the American Railway Union. Railroad workers were protesting wage cuts of more than 30%, and their strike brought trains across the country to a sudden halt. Federal lawyers persuaded a compliant judge to issue a sweeping injunction, which barred not only force or violence by strikers, but also banned any form of persuasion of non-strikers, including the distribution of handbills. Debs vowed to defy the injunction and called on union members to refrain from violence. But tempers flared and striking workers battled federal troops in Chicago in July of 1894. When the gunfire ended, 13 people lay dead and 700 were jailed. Federal marshals arrested Debs for contempt of court, and he was sentenced to 2 years in prison for violating the injunction simply by denouncing its terms. The Supreme Court upheld what critics called government by injunction when it unanimously upheld Debs' conviction. Justice David Brewer wrote for a court that included several former railroad lawyers, including himself. And he spoke like a military officer. "The strong arm of the national government may brush away all obstructions to the freedom of interstate commerce. If the emergency arises, the army of the nation and all its militia are at the service of the nation to compel obedience to its laws." Reaction to the court's ruling in the Debs case split along political lines. One conservative lawyer applauded the court for saving the country from what he called a reign of anarchy and bloodshed. On the other side, Democrats adopted a platform in the presidential campaign of 1896 that deplored government by injunction as a new and highly dangerous form of oppression by federal judges. But the Republicans won that election and the next three, and Republican presidents named 10 Supreme Court justices over the next 16 years. We're going to move now into the 20th century and look at two landmark cases that both tested the court's commitment to the liberty of contract doctrine. One of these cases, Lochner versus New York, gave its name to the period of three decades that followed the court's decision in 1905. The Lochner era spanned the first third of the century, a time of conflict between political conservatives and a broad coalition of populist and socialist groups. Labor unions, ranging from the bread-and-butter approach of the American Federation of Labor to the class war appeals of the industrial workers of the world, pressed for laws to protect working people from long hours and low wages. One lobbying effort paid off in 1897 when the New York legislature passed a statute limiting the working hours of bakers to 10 per day and 60 per week. The driving force behind the law was Henry Weissman of the Journeyman Bakers Union. He presented lawmakers with medical reports on the serious health problem of bakers, from inhaling flour dust in unventilated bakeries and from working long hours on their feet. The law's preamble stated that it was enacted as a health measure. Joseph Lochner owned a family bakery in Utica, a small city in upstate New York. Some disgruntled employees complained to state inspectors that Lochner was violating the law, and he was convicted and fined $50 for making a baker named Amon Schmitter work more than 60 hours each week. After New York's highest court upheld his conviction, Lochner took his appeal to the Supreme Court. His battery of lawyers included Henry Weissman, who had switched sides and was now counsel for the State Association of Master Bakers. Weissman relied on the liberty of contract doctrine in his Supreme Court brief, writing that each new attempt by the states to interfere with the contract and property rights and freedom to exercise a trade or calling by the citizen should be closely scrutinized by this court. Weissman also denied that bakery work posed any health problems. "Average bakery of the present day," he said, "is well ventilated, comfortable both summer and winter, and always sweet smelling." New York's Attorney General, Julius Mayer, filed a brief with no rhetorical flourish, simply claiming that the work hour law is a proper exercise of the police power of the state. by the narrow margin of 5-4, the Supreme Court sided with Joseph Lochner over Amon Schmitter. Justice Rufus Peckham, who had earlier served on the New York State Court that upheld the work hours law, broke with his former colleagues in reversing their decision. Peckham began on an uncompromising note. The statute necessarily interferes with the right of contract between the employer and employees in New York's bakeries. He asserted that the work hours statute was, as he put it, not really a health law at all. And he concluded that the limit of the police power has been reached and passed in this case. Justice John Marshall Harlan wrote for three of the four dissenters in the Lochner case. It was plain to Harlan, he said, that the law was designed to protect the health of bakers who were compelled to work long hours under conditions that, as he put it, unduly taxed their strength. Harlan preached the doctrine of judicial restraint. Judges should presume the constitutionality of regulatory laws, and he said, keep their hands off. Whether or not this be wise legislation, it is not the province of the court to inquire. But the sharpest retort to Peckham came from Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, whose two-page dissent was packed with memorable phrases. Holmes took issue with the liberty of contract doctrine and cautioned, as he put it, that general propositions do not decide concrete cases. He argued that a constitution is not intended to embody a particular economic theory, whether of paternalism or of laissez-faire. It is made for people of fundamentally differing views. Holmes chided the majority justices for substituting their views for those of elected lawmakers. I strongly believe, Holmes wrote, that my agreement or disagreement has nothing to do with the right of a majority to embody their opinion in law. However narrow the margin, the Lochner ruling set a precedent that lasted for another three decades. Under the liberty of contract doctrine, laws that regulated working hours and wages violated the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. But the court did recognize one exception to this doctrine. The Oregon legislature passed a law that limited the working hours of women in laundries to 10 per day. The law was challenged by Kurt Muller, who owned the Lace House Laundry in Portland. Like Joseph Lochner, he had been convicted and fined for requiring an employee to work longer than 10 hours. In Muller's case, the worker was a woman named Elizabeth Gotcher. As we saw, New York's Attorney General had submitted a very thin brief to the Supreme Court in the Lochner case. But in the case of Muller versus Oregon, the state hired Louis Brandeis to argue before the court. Now, as we saw in our previous lecture, Brandeis was known as the people's lawyer for defending workers and consumers, and he presented the court with a brief that included more than 100 pages of medical reports on the damaging effects of long hours on the health of women workers. Justice David Brewer, who had joined the Lochner majority, wrote for a unanimous court in the Muller case, upholding the Oregon law. Although he cited Lochner for the right to contract over working hours, Brewer looked to what he called the special physical organization of women to justify an exception to that ruling. Because, as Brewer wrote, healthy mothers are essential to vigorous offspring, the physical well-being of woman becomes an object of public interest and care in order to preserve the strength and vigor of the race. Although Brewer cited the very copious brief that Louis Brandeis had presented, it was obviously a sense of male chivalry that prompted the nine men on the court to favor Elizabeth Gotcher over Kurt Muller. We've looked in this lecture at the battles within the court over the doctrine of substantive due process, from the Munn case in 1877 through the Muller decision in 1908. As more justices came from the ranks of corporate lawyers, the advocates of liberty of contract came to dominate the court during this period of conflicts over economic regulation. In our next lecture, we'll look at the court's response to conflicts over the regulation of speech during World War I, in which the liberty to criticize the government during warfare came under fire.